Hi, this is Katie Day and welcome to Creating Ripples, the programme that showcases inspirational women across the globe. Sometimes it is the small acts and achievements that can create the biggest ripples. We're here to share some amazing stories. They will make you laugh. Sometimes they may make you cry. They will always inspire you. Today, it is my absolute pleasure to be interviewing one of my really dear and gorgeous friends, Elaine Copeland. Elaine grew up with the belief and understanding that we can take responsibility for our own health and well-being. Her great-grandmother grew remedies in her garden and was the administrator of the prescriptions which came weekly from the doctor's surgery in the next town. The patients gathered in her parlour to collect their medicine. So the philosophy of complementary health was already born in Elaine's family when she arrived in the world. Having been a sufferer of eczema from an early age, it was logical that this would become Elaine's specialisation when she became a full-time health and well-being consultant in 1998. Before that time, Elaine worked in design management for 25 years and had left her commercial employment in a senior position at a major investment bank when she realised that she was not following her passion and was suffering from chronic eczema. Part of the deepening of her belief in complementary medicine was the healing of her own eczema at that time, a condition which is still under control today. A few years ago, Elaine realised that she was in a situation which no longer worked for her and in which she felt fearful, worthless and controlled. A million miles from who she remembered she was and who she believed she could be again. She took action in the face of fear and adversity and now works to be a support for women in similar situations and who are finding it difficult to live an authentic life. Elaine practices kinesiology, counselling and liberating touch to assist clients in identifying subconscious blocks, manage fear and move through vulnerability to achieve change and progression. She is passionate about self-development, curious about everything, and likes exploration and discovery. She notices and appreciates the excellence of people in their everyday experience and enjoys sharing the exploration of clients and their successes. Thank you, Elaine.
Well, thank you
for being interviewed. It's very different dynamic, slightly different dynamic, isn't it, from friends to kind of being interviewed. But as I say to everybody, this just happens to be a chat that just happens to be recorded. It's not an interview at all, really.
No, I just have to think about the millions of people out there.
Forget about them. Nobody listens. Yeah. There was one sentence in here that I really, really loved. She notices and appreciates the excellence of people in their everyday experience. What a lovely phrase. Mm. What does that mean for you?
It's about recognizing that sometimes you said in your introduction right at the beginning about the little things that we do every day that I think a lot of the times we can not necessarily forget, but that we can put aside and not take value in. And it may be that it's picking the kids up from school when you've just had a phone call that is difficult.
Right.
It might be looking after a parent with dementia or a relative. That those things that are part of everyday life that we tend to think of, you just got to get on and cope with it. But people are hugely strong in managing that. And one of my favourite quotes, if you like, is from Man Ray, who was a photographer in the 1930s. Mm-hmm. And there's a wonderful picture that he took that I use when we do some presentations, and I'm going to hopefully use in the book that I'm producing at the moment, which is a pair of lips with lipstick on. And he said that he admired women hugely because no matter what was going on in their life, they could always steady their hand enough to put their lipstick on. And for me, there's something in what we do as women that there is that core in us where we're able to draw on that and do those things, even though we've got all this stuff going on in our life.
Yeah.
And you and I just talked before we started the interview about, you know, men do that too. This is not about being exclusive of men. But women, I think, have got an extraordinary strength. And I love seeing that just in just little things that, you know, people call them little things, but they're not little things. They can be just, you know, picking up a phone call and applying for a job can be massive, you know, depending on your experience and your background and what's going on for you.
I didn't know that Man Ray quote. It's great, isn't it? And it's very, very true. Another a quote that I love from Nancy Reagan, women are like tea bags, saying, you know, their strengths when put in hot water. I mean, it does kind of sum us up, doesn't it? Which doesn't, as you rightly say, it doesn't mean to say that men don't have strengths, because they have enormous strengths, and it is about celebrating the differences, not about criticizing the differences, because it's only by differences that we have a more powerful world.
Absolutely.
If we were all the same, it'd be unbelievably boring. I didn't know that about your great grandmother. That was a really lovely story when you sent me your bio. I thought, oh gosh, I didn't know that actually that philosophy was already part of your DNA when you arrived on this planet.
That
was amazing.
I hadn't, until I wrote that in that way, I hadn't really thought about it being there when I was born. It's something that I've known about in my family history.
Right.
That I thought I had taken on board as I grew up, and that's why I do what I do, because, you know. But actually, it was already there when I was in the womb. And, you know.
Yeah.
And, she used to grow lily leaves in her background, Lily of the Valley. And she, my mother told me that she used to put them in whiskey and keep them in a bottle.
Okay.
And I said to Mum, you know, why did she do that? She said, I've got no idea. And then I was talking to a really lovely friend of mine, Beryl Doig, who's now a retired homeopath. And Beryl said, oh, yeah, they used to use lily leaves in whiskey for binding wounds.
Oh, my gosh.
So they would take them out. I don't know whether they washed them. I imagine they would, because that would be pretty tough on a wound, wouldn't it? But they would wrap the wound and then bind it in a bandage, and it would draw out the poison in the wound. So she was doing that for someone. And she grew arnica, and she made remedies and things. So my mother grew up with that as a child. My mother lost her mother when she was 16, so her grandmother became very much the person who she then was influential in her life to a greater extent. The house is about, I'd say, probably 200 or 300 yards from where my mother now is, because she's back in the village where I was born. She told me this story, and the front step is in New Biggin Street in Thaxted in Essex, and the front step of the house has got a dip in the middle where it's worn away by so many feet, which I kind of like as well. And she the doctor would come over to the town once a week, so if you're ill you have to like wait a week. he'd come over, and then you'd see the doctor, he'd write the prescription. He'd go back to Saffron Walden, which is about 8 miles away, the nearest big town as it was then. The pharmacist would make up the medicines. They would then put them in a brown paper package tied up with string, give them to the bus driver.
Good grief.
Amazing, isn't it?
Good grief.
Take them, the bus driver would then take them over and put them on my great-grandmother's front step.
Wow.
And then she would, everybody knew that it was on a certain day of the week, Tuesday, I think, and they would come and sit in her parlour, and then she would take the medicines out and administer them.
How amazing.
I mean, she wasn't medically trained. She was just, that's why I put administrator, because she was just fulfilling an administrative function, really.
But that
idea that she was not giving orthodox medicine, but she was involved in that process, so thereby not... how can I put it? I suppose embracing it, which is how I feel. You know, I do work with complementary medicine, but I'm very much of the opinion that it fits with orthodox medicine. You know, I'm not what I would call an alternative therapist. I'm not anti-orthodox medicine. I think medical science is incredible, and we have a lot to thank it for.
Absolutely.
So it can work. The two things can work.
Yeah, and it's that word complementary rather than alternative.
Definitely.
Isn't it? And it's working alongside. And I one of the things I can remember you saying when we both used to go to the same business networking group, when you used to stand up and say who you are and what you did, was, you know, if I fall over and break my leg, I don't want somebody waving a crystal over me on them to send me to the emergency room.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's true. You know, orthodox medicine, whatever you want to call it, the scientific medicine, although it's very, very young when you compare it to the, you know, your great-grandmother, which has been around for thousands of years, you know, traditional medicine is a lot older than pharmaceutical medicine.
Yeah.
But it absolutely has its place, and it has saved thousands, millions of lives. I mean, I thank God for it. But it is having those two working alongside as a complement to each other, isn't it? Not one or the other, but actually both.
And I think what we do in complementary health a lot of the time is prevention as well. And also working with, you know, the emotional issues. A lot of our physical conditions can come from an emotional place.
Yeah.
You know, if you think about somebody who has the weight of the world on their shoulders, then their posture's not very good. You know, they're probably not making a lot of eye contact, the corners of the mouth are probably down. You know, those kind of things over time can affect us physically. So bad posture, we know, can affect our digestion, all those kind of things. And it's quite a simplistic explanation. But I believe that, I mean, I work with the Bach Flower Remedies as well, and Dr. Bach was very much of that opinion in the 1930s when he created those remedies. And psychoneuroimmunology, the way our brain and our emotions affect our physicality, is, you know, I see it a lot. You know, people who come with IBS, for instance, or Crohn's or things like that, it's very often coming from an emotional state. In my eczema, chronic eczema, that was coming from an emotional state. I mean, there's an element of genetics there, because my mother had suffered with eczema, and so did my great, you know. But I think the stimulus of that for me, and in an awful lot of the children that I treated, because I specialised in eczema with children, that stimulus is very often an emotional stress. And then it manifests as a physical thing, you know. So
it's about the body being in dis-ease, isn't it? And if you can put the body back into ease, something somebody said to me years ago, listen to the body when it's whispering, don't wait until it starts shouting.
That's nice. Yeah.
But we don't, we're so busy, we're so busy doing that we forget to stop and be and actually listen, because our bodies will tell us everything that we need to know if we just stop long enough to listen to them. What I found out about Chinese medicine, which I thought was amazing, is similar principle. People pay the Chinese herbal doctor to stay well, and if they get ill, he has to pay them because he hasn't done his job properly. That's which I think is amazing.
That philosophy comes, you know, that whole philosophy of you work to stay well rather than fix yourself when you're ill. And that's really the basis of complementary medicine, is that we are trying to, like you say, remove that disease in the body, so bring it into balance, and so that therefore you're not having that cumulative effect over time, which then makes you ill. You know, so exactly that.
How do you get the message across, though? Because certainly in the West, what I notice with the work that I do, just on a training and consultancy basis, is of how many people are living in blame. So it's much easier to go through life and live in fear and live in blame and project outwards to other people, to situation, people and events, everything that isn't right with your life. And not many people are prepared to own that themselves and make the internal changes that they need to do, because it takes courage. It takes some inward looking, which can be a bit scary, takes you out of your comfort zone. It can be admitting perhaps that you may not have done things the best way in the past, and you don't want to admit that, so it's much easier just to gloss over it and blame everybody else. How do you get through that block with people and get them, not get them, that's the wrong word, but encourage them to take ownership of their journey?
That's really interesting. While you were asking me that question, there was lots of like neurons firing in my head, like, oh yeah, you know. I think we live in a more and more, that's not very good English, but you know what I mean, more and more externally referenced life. And that blame is an external reference, isn't it? It's putting the focus on somebody else and not taking responsibility for what is going on for you. And I think that that's becoming more and more so in our life. I mean, I heard a thing on the radio this last week where they're saying something like 40% of teenagers now are suffering with anxiety. You know, it's like, what is going on there? What's happening? And, you know, that engagement through, I'm not an anti-technology person by any means, but that engagement with people through technology rather than one-to-one, looking somebody in the eye, being really with someone. And I think the way, to answer your question, I try and walk the talk. I try and be with people. I try and be vulnerable. Show myself, be present. And when I do that, I find that people feel they can be with me. And if not all the time, but people see that, experience that, it touches something in them. So I don't talk about, when I go and do my networking and stuff like that, I don't talk about what kinesiology does or what liberating touch does. I get people to think about them. So one of the things I'll say to people is think of something that you really love doing. You know, whatever that is, playing golf, wrestling on the floor with your kids, taking your dog out for a walk, looking at a sunset, eating pineapple. I don't know why that came into my head, but, you know, whatever it is. Think about that. And when you think about that, notice how you feel in your body around that. So it goes back to what we were talking about, the psychoneuroimmunology. It's like you have a visceral biological response to a thought process through remembering perhaps an experience. When you think about something you hate, something you don't like doing, going to the dentist or, you know, whatever it is, you have a physical, biological experience, but it's different.
Yeah.
So when people can cotton onto that and go, oh, yeah, see where she's going with this, I can then talk about towards motivation, away motivation. So I work very much with towards motivation. So the end result might be the very same thing. So the end result might be, say, getting something perfect. I was talking about this with an engineer this week, last week. And I was saying, if you've got a fear of not getting something perfect, not being perfect, which is a big problem in our world right now, being perfect, the perfect mother, the you know, whatever. If you've got a fear of not being perfect, that's an away from motivation. Whereas if you've got a desire to get it perfect, then that's a towards motivation. So the first one's stressful. The second one is actually quite a nice feeling. You know, I'm going to get this really right. Now, if you're an engineer, getting it perfect is really important. So it's not about, my work is not about making you somebody you're not. It's not about going from fear of not getting it perfect to going, oh, well, I don't, really don't care. It's about, okay, I'm still going to get it perfect, but I'm going to do it with joy.
You know? It's a different energy. Isn't it? And also it's a different energy you're putting into the process and putting into the end result, whether that's a product, a service, you know, something tangible, something ethereal. You're putting that energy. So the benefit that people are going to get from it must change as well, because they're getting a different energy from what you're putting out there.
I think so. I think that's really, you know, you notice it in something like a craft show. You know, if you go and you see something that's made with love and joy, you know, if you're open to energy, if you're open to it, you see it and you think, wow, you know, that's got something about it. You might not be able to really put your finger on it. And then you look at something that's just kind of churned out, you know, and you can think about that in big companies as well. You can think about, you know, multinational companies that have got that kind of ethos. They have a different feel about
it. They do.
Yeah.
Well, even something as basic as you know, if you walk into a room where people have just had an argument, you absolutely know. Because the energy in that room, you will pick it up, even though nothing is being said. And they may not be in that room. You know, when you're house hunting, when I was found the apartment that I'm living in, the moment I walked through the door, it hugged me. And it hugs me every time I walk through my front door 16 years later, because it has the right energy. So energies, we really don't put enough importance on what we can't see. You know, it has to be, we live in a very tangible world, that if I can't see it, touch it, feel it, do something physical with it, then it doesn't actually exist.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's tapping into your great-grandmother and that ancient wisdom.
Yeah.
And in the West, we've lost sight of that ancient wisdom, haven't we? Not completely. I think it's there's a resurgence in wanting to get back to it.
Yeah, I think it is resurging. Yeah.
Which is good.
Right word. Yeah, it is. And I think when I talk to people, you know, we are people are different, and some, you know, I'm a kinesthetic visual. So you ask me how something feels, I can tell you. Mm. And I can tell you what it looked like.
Mm.
Whereas if you're a digital auditory person, you might find that a bit hard.
Yeah.
So, you know, if I'm in a network meeting, I can see the people that get it straight away, and the people are going, well, you know, yeah, I can see what she's saying, but I'm not quite with it, you know.
Yeah.
But when you do that, when you talk about things like that, if you walk into a room, they go, oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I get it.
Okay, well, that's energy. That's, you know, oh, right, okay. They can relate to that.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. I know you can't obviously talk about specific cases, but what have been some of your experiences of working with clients? What changes have you seen? Can you talk about that in a general term without giving away any confidentialities?
Yeah, I mean, there are some testimonials on my website.
Oh, okay.
That people have shared things, and so they're there for, you know, specifics. In general, I think it goes back to what we were talking about to start with. It's about people making changes, doing things that they didn't think they could do. Mm. The thing that I suppose I get most of a kick out of is when people come back and they say, and you know, I'll say, how'd it go? You know, how have you been since last session? Noticed anything? And they go, no. Not really, you know, I think I'm just the same. And so you go through I go through my notes and I say, well, how's the headaches? Oh, I haven't had a headache for 2 weeks. And okay, so how's your stomach? You know, and again, it's like, oh, well, that's better. And then I might say, how are you sleeping? Yeah, I've slept right through. And, you know, and it makes me smile because I think we sometimes, when you and I were talking about this again, we don't realise how far we've come.
Mm.
And it's very easy for us to notice where we're not rather than where we are. And so I love doing that, feeding them. They go, oh, yeah, things are much better, aren't they? You know, whereas people will come back and they'll say, oh, yeah, I made that phone call. Or very rarely will people come back and go, do you know what? I was fantastic. I did this. I do that. You know, you were fantastic. I hope that's amazing that you know, that you did that. But we are very, I think, very, I don't know, kind of, I think it's because on a physical level, our body knows what we need to get well, given the right stimulus.
Mm.
And I think on an emotional level, we know that as well. And when we do it, because we've done it, before we were going to do it, it was really scary.
Mm.
Then when we've done it, it's like, oh, yeah, I did that. Yeah, I did. And you think, well, that's amazing, isn't it? Well, yeah, but I just did it. You know, because we get to a point where we think, okay, right, I'm going to do this now. I'm ready. Mm. And we do it. So the impact on us is not so big as when we were thinking about doing it, when we were really scared.
Yeah.
You know, we've gone, okay, I'm going to, you know, to quote a book, feel the fear and do it anyway. I'm going to grab this and be out there and do it. And I think that's partly why. But it is that. It's seeing people move through their barriers and achieve what they want to achieve. And that can be a big thing, but it can also be what could be perceived as a very small thing. That first step when you decide, yeah, this is going to change now. I'm not going to live my life this way anymore. Mm. I am going to step over that line that I've drawn myself in the sand. Mm. And I don't know where that's going to take me beyond that, but I'm willing to take that first step. And I see people do that all the time.
And we forget, don't we, that we didn't go from crawling to being able to walk on two legs without falling over a few times.
Yeah.
We didn't go from baby scribble talk to having a command of the whole vocabulary in the English language without, you know, everything that we acquire, every skill that we acquire as a human being, we go through the stages. And when we get to be an adult, we forget that stages are important.
Process is really important.
Yeah, and absolutely. We expect to go from not being able to do something to, okay, I want to make a change now, to expect in 24 hours we will be at the end point. Of course, it's not how it happens. Now, okay, you can't talk about specific cases with clients, but I am one of your clients, so I can talk about specific.
Thank you.
Because I've given myself permission to talk about that, and you're not saying it, so you're not breaking any confidences. I did some work with you a few years ago around unblocking love, the block that I had to love. And I remember we did a huge amount of work with that, which you took me through, which was really tricky for me because I put up barriers. I mean, the whole armor was there with padlocks from head to foot. And we worked through first unlocking the padlocks, then maybe actually taking the padlock off, and then maybe actually having a chink in that armor, just a little bit of daylight coming through to see if what that felt like before the armor fell off completely. And it didn't happen immediately. I think it happened probably a year, maybe slightly more after we did the work, that I met the man I'm with now. And it's the first adult-to-adult relationship I've ever had, rather than victim child or whatever, critical parent, victim child. And when I was last year, I found something in a drawer in my office that I had written 10 years previously on New Year's Eve with two other girlfriends. And it was two sides of A4 of the characteristics of my ideal man. And I'd completely forgotten I'd written it. Mm. And I was reading it through and thinking of Roger. And I was going, tick, 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 turnover, tick, tick, tick. Oh, my God. Okay, took 10 years for him to manifest. Mm-hmm. But actually, it took about a year after working with you for him to manifest. And before then, I wasn't ready.
Yeah.
So that is a testimonial, actually, of how... how working, once you're ready to face your fears and move through things, how things can happen. But it probably won't happen overnight.
Yeah.
And it might.
Thank you for sharing that with me, you know, on this interview, because that means an awful lot to me. And I think the thing that we forget is that we have to be patient with ourselves.
Mm. And we're not, are we?
No. And, you know, compassion for ourselves and going, okay, you know, I may not be where I want to be, but I'm okay. I'm doing the best I can, rather than having that negative voice that we have. And, you know, I do that. I'm not saying, you know, I'm just because I'm a therapist, you know, I got it sorted because I haven't. You know, I'm in process too.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not perfect. You know, it's not something I'm striving for. I'm just striving to, you know, be where I am in every moment of the day and be present. But yeah, the patience with ourselves and the comparison, the compassion that we need to give as much compassion to ourselves as we give to other people.
Absolutely.
And very often we don't do that. We can be our hardest critic. Oh,
most people are.
Yeah.
Yeah. When I'm working with clients and I say, the way you've just spoken about yourself, would you talk to your best friend like that? And they look at me in absolute horror. Well, of course I wouldn't. So why are you talking to yourself like that? But we are so self-critical, aren't we? You know, generally speaking, human beings are incredibly self-critical.
Yeah.
You briefly mentioned at the beginning of the interview about a book. Mm. Is that something you want to talk about, or would you rather not talk about it?
Well, since my process is about being vulnerable and you know, putting myself out there, I guess yes,
okay.
I will talk about it. Where to start with that? Yeah, I'm in the process of writing a book, which I may never publish.
Okay.
Because that's the coach I'm working with, Judy Bentley.
Yeah.
Wonderful NLP practitioner, and who is a great friend of us both.
Yeah.
It's going to sound like a very incestuous interview. she's working with me on it and coaching me through it. And where I am with it now is that I may never publish it. And the reason that I'm saying that is because that gives me freedom to write it.
Yeah.
And the reason I need that freedom to write it is because it's scary to write.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's going over, it's writing about a period in my life, which I was only thinking the other day, it's like it was a bad dream.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, it's almost becoming a bit kind of soft that I can look at it and kind of touch it. Whereas before it was right in my face because it was fresh.
Yeah.
Whereas now I'm moving from it, it's become a bit softer and go, oh yeah, you know, I can, it's kind of getting a misty kind of feel to it, which is interesting, because every now and then it's like there's something that keys into that experience and bang, it's like trauma again.
Yeah.
And I've done enough work on myself to be able to recognize that, maybe not right in the very moment, but then I'll think, okay, I'll process what's going on for me here. I feel jangled. Mm. What's this about?
Mm.
And this is something that I teach my clients to do. You know, it's like being with yourself. It's like that patience thing we were just talking about. It's like, what is going on with me, rather than numbing it out and just pretending it's not there. It's like, okay, I realize I'm in a funny place now. What is it? So it still will pop up, but generally it's starting to feel a bit softer. And I was in a relationship and realized that relationship wasn't working for me. And I, like you said in my introduction, I felt worthless and controlled. And it was crazy making, because I was, everything in me was saying, this doesn't feel right for me. This just does not feel, I'm not happy. But the relationship I was in, I was feeling there's something wrong with me. And I'm choosing my words very carefully here, not to blame, because I went into that relationship with of my own volition. Nobody made me. And I stayed in it of my own volition. Nobody made me stay there. And I think it's very easy to get into that blaming place. And I've written a chapter in the book about blame, because blame keeps you powerless. And I don't want to live my life in a powerless place. So I take responsibility for my part in the relationship as well, and for the feelings that I had about it and the reasons that I needed to leave it. And the blame thing is, I can talk about the other person's behaviour and how that affected me. Now, that behaviour is probably negotiable as far as that person's concerned, you know, but it's my response to that behaviour I can own, and that's non-negotiable because it was my response. Now, I own that response. I don't blame that other person for my response. I own it. And I feel like that is the key to my freedom, because as long as I say, you made me, I'm stuck. So the book is about saying, this was my experience in this relationship, and this is how I got out of it. This is what happened. And the story of how I got out of it is really funny as well. I mean, there it's not a heavy book. There are lots of aspects of it which are hilarious, you know. In terms of the process of it, I mean, I can say that now that I'm not in it, of course. but looking back on it, and I'm hoping what it will do is it will, if I publish it, and I probably will, but, you know, saying that gets me off the hook a little bit for now. I'm hoping it will enable people to think, well, she did that, I can maybe do it for me too. And it may not be about leaving a relationship in their life. It might be about handling some bad news, or having a relationship with their daughter, or you know, interviewing for a job, or running their own business. It could be any of those things. It doesn't have to be, you know, it's not like a blueprint. It's just this is what happened for me, and this is what I did for me in that world, in my world. And there's also going to be a bit of a self-help aspect to it as well, because I'm going to talk about liberating touch and kinesiology and bark flower remedies and how I help myself with that. But the key thing that I hope will come from it is that you can't do it alone, that you need help from other people. And that goes back to the vulnerability thing, because to say I can't do this on my own, I need help, is very often the first step to recovery. And it feels huge, because, you know, I had lots of shoulds. You know, I should stay in this relationship. I stood on opposite this man and said, I will be with you. I took my vows, you know, through hell or high water, nothing can stop this kind of thing. And I went back on that. So I had to get my head around that, that I should be stronger, I should be a better wife, I should, you know, all of those things, and I'm shoulding on myself, you know. So I had to get over that, and then to go and actually admit that I was in the relationship I was in was really hard to not get into a place of I've failed or I'm a bad person or, you know, all of that. So I'm about, I suppose, I would say, I haven't written it yet, so I don't know how far I am through it, but I feel like I'm probably about just over halfway through it.
Okay.
Yeah. So I had a commitment with Jude, which I'm put on myself, that I would finish it by the end of last month.
Okay.
She's like, she texts me and she's like, you know, I've been thinking about this commitment that you've made to yourself. You know, I just want to give you the permission to go like, hey, you know, maybe not. And of course I haven't finished it, and that's okay.
Yeah.
You know, it will, I believe things happen when they're supposed to happen. Mm. You know, our wonderful friend Emily, who I listened to the interview that you'd done with it a while ago, and you know, she always says everything's exactly as it should be, otherwise it would be different.
Mm.
And it's about, you know, it's not necessarily how it's going to be in the end, but it's how it is right now. Mm. So I'm in process with it, and writing it has been healing in lots of ways, and like I said, it's been funny. I must tell you just one story, because I've said it's funny and people are going to have a kind of curiosity about that, I imagine. There's one chapter called We Don't Need Marmalade, because I don't want it to be a really heavy, worthy kind of tomb. Yeah. You know, I want it to have an essence of me in it, and that, you know, when I work with my clients, there is an element of fun with what I do. And it's called We Don't Need Marmalade, and I was in the position where I had when I look back on it now, I'd realised that each time I came to step that little bit further to doing what I was going to do, which was leave my husband, I put something in the way. Right. The first thing was, I can't leave because what about my cat?
Okay.
You know, that was the very first thing. And then, so, you know, I'd pack my stuff. I'd got to the point where I need that it was done. I was done. And I was in the kitchen and I had the fridge door open. And my very, very good friend who had helped me through this 2-day process, and I'm going to ask her to write a chapter in the book about her experience of what went on. She came in the kitchen. She said, Elaine, what are you doing? I said, I'm just getting the marmalade. She looked at me and she went, I've got marmalade. We don't need marmalade. And I'm like, right. And I looked at her and I could see the look in her eyes. She just wasn't saying anything. She was just standing there. And there was that moment. And I'm like, okay, I'm done. This is it.
This is it.
So I went, right, okay. So I put the marmalade back in the fridge and closed the fridge door. And that was it. That was me leaving. But I was still very much full of fear. And, you know, and was for a long time after that. Mm. I mean, I've been out of that relationship for 5 years, but only divorced for 3 months. Mm. And it took me a long... Yeah, and I was very clear that I wanted to be in my process about it, you know, because I was thinking, damn, this is good material, you know, at one level. But at the other was, you know, this is what I do. This is what I teach. I have to walk the talk. Mm. I have to learn from this, you know, so...
It is amazing. Did you use any of what you use with clients with yourself? Did you do
very much so.
Liberating touch on your cat? Is it something that you can do
with
yourself?
Kinesiology is a little bit harder to do on yourself. Kinesiology is about using a muscle feedback in the body. There's a bit on my website that explains, gives my explanation of kinesiology, which I won't take up time to do here. But that is about using a muscle biofeedback, and I can do that for myself, but I can influence.
Right.
So it's like, okay, you know, is it safe and appropriate for me to have another glass of wine? Yes, of course it is. You know, I can do that. So sometimes it's difficult to get out of your own way.
Okay.
But liberating touch that I studied with the gorgeous Ranjana Apu, who is such a light in my life. I learned that with her. And it's about using the energy points that we use in kinesiology, that we use in EFT, to take the stress out of something. So to give you an example, when the house sold, it had taken 2 years to sell the house through various reasons. And my ex-husband was still living in the home, in the house, and I was where I am now. And the house sold, and I was on my own at home, and I share my friend's house, and I was on my own, and she was out, and it was a Friday morning, and I was waiting for the confirmation that the money had come through, that the house had actually sold. And I got the text from the estate agent, but I really wanted to see it in my bank account. So I made myself a cup of coffee and I sat down and I thought, okay, so I checked my bank account and there it was. And there was this moment of, oh my God, it's done. And I then had this thought, this little gremlin on my shoulder said, well, of course, now you're going to have to move out because you've sold the house. Because there's no reason to be living with my friend now.
Right.
Because I've got the money. I can buy. And lots of people had said to me, oh, you know, when you're divorced, are you going to buy it? What are you going to do? And I'm like, I don't know. You know, I'm going to decide that when I get to it. But there was this moment of, oh, well, now I'm going to have to move out. And I thought, I caught it. And I thought, isn't that interesting? Why do I think that? And I got really what I call jangled. You know, I just didn't feel right. And I felt emotional and I wanted to cry, but I couldn't cry. It was just a lot going on in me. It was like it was something bubbling in me. And it was a day out of work, so I was sewing. And I sat on my sewing machine and I couldn't thread a needle. I couldn't thread it. And I wanted to do this particular, and I just knew that if I did it, I'd mess it up. And I'm like, what is going on for me? You know, so I did some liberating touch, which is tapping these points, and I got through to the next stage of it. So I was able to get myself to a calmer place with it and realize that I was actually giving myself a hard time because I was thinking, you know, I'm not good enough to be here. You know, she's only done it out of the goodness of her heart, you know. And Bridge, you know, she came home and I'm like, she said, are you all right? And I went, no. And she said, no, I didn't think you were. And so she sat down with me and she said, what's going on? And I told her the story and she said, you can stay here for as long as you like. And I said, yeah, I know that at head level. I know that mentally, but I just wasn't feeling it. And we talked it through and I did some more liberating touch on it. And what I did then was I embedded, I can stay here. This is just my fear. Because it's like, okay, it's the equivalent of we don't need marmalade. Because it's like the next stage, right? Okay, now you've divorced, you've got the money from the house. So now you've got to move on now.
Yeah.
You know, and in my life, I have been quite quick to move on sometimes. In my supervision group with my supervisor at the time, Maggie McKenzie, who's at Spectrum Therapy, where I studied psychotherapy, she said, you're like a racehorse. You know, you're in the stalls and the doors open, off you fly. It's like, right, what can I do next? And over the last year and a half, 2 years, I've actively really tried. I haven't tried. I've succeeded in tempering that in me. So I'll have an idea and I think, okay, that's an idea. Right, don't do anything about it just yet. Just sit with it for a while and see how you feel about it. So that was really what I embedded with the liberating touch when I was talking to Bridge about needing to move on. It's like, you know, okay, I'm where I am for now and let's just see where I am, you know.
It's not easy though, is it? When you have that as part of your makeup, which I absolutely recognise because why? It's you know, I want to get from A to Z, but I can't be bothered to go through B, C, D, E, F, G.
Yeah, and it's when you find out that actually G is really important.
Yeah.
But you wouldn't have known it unless you got to H.
I know, hugely, hugely. And I think it's, well, for me, it's about wanting everything to be in inverted commas perfect, and not, and thinking if I can fast forward to the end result, it's like the fairy stories that I was read as a child, and they lived happily ever after. Yeah. And I recognised I spent my whole adult life trying to fast forward to, and they lived happily ever after. Mm. And actually, happily ever after doesn't actually exist.
Mm.
And you might get a version of happily ever after, but only if you go through the stages in the process.
Yeah. And what comes to me when you say that is that our goal is what we want, isn't it? You know, we're striving to be happy, that, you know, striving to be comfortable with ourselves or confident enough or whatever it is. And that's what we want. So our focus is naturally on that.
Mm.
And I think what's important to get us to that place is to really just be grateful for what we have right now.
Mm.
And if we can do that and be in that place, it makes being in that process easier.
Mm.
Because you're not always in that place of, well, yeah, but I haven't got that.
Mm.
It's like, you know, being present and
grateful. Enjoying the journey and appreciating the journey and celebrating the journey and stopping to smell the roses on the way. And not just walking so quickly to the end that you actually don't see the beauty that's surrounding you in any particular moment along that journey.
Yeah.
And you might get stung by a stinging nettle and walk through some hawthorns or what have you and get scratched. And that's okay as well, because around the next corner will be the remedy to that.
Mm.
And it's fine.
Mm. And if you're a self-aware person, that never stops.
Absolutely.
Because we're growing. Yeah. You know, if you're somebody who's not doing that, and, you know, there are people that don't want to know about this stuff.
And that's fine.
Yeah, that's their choice. Mm. And but they don't get that, or do they? I don't know. Do they get that sense, you know?
Maybe their body does.
I sort of check myself halfway through saying that, thinking, do they feel that? But, yeah.
Interesting, isn't it? Maybe on a soul level, but not on an ego head-led level.
Are they really happy?
Yeah.
Not knowing. I don't know.
Who knows? And they don't know either. That could be a whole other interview. So I'm asking you this question rather ironically and with a smile on my face, because you've already kind of told us the answer. But do you know, what does the future hold for you?
What does the future hold? I know what I'd like it to hold. I want to deepen the work I do with people now. I want to deepen myself. I do think that I'm teaching what I'm here to learn.
Interesting.
Know, it's like you can be a really good guitar teacher if you're two steps ahead of your pupils. It's like you've got to keep out in front.
Yeah.
And in self-development, I think that's, you know, I don't feel like I've cracked it. I don't feel like I'm complete or that I've, you know, got the answer. I'm just doing what I do in my life and hopefully helping people get to where they are in their life. So I really would like to continue doing that. I've got some thoughts about further study that I might do in that area. And particular people that I'm reading and looking at right now. Brené Brown is one of them. I just love her work and love her delivery of her work.
It's brilliant.
I'm very much in, you know, I've mentioned vulnerability and all those things a lot in this session today, and but I really want to know more about that, so I'm very much drawn to her. And just as long as I'm in a place where I feel I'm doing what I need to do right now, that's really been my learning over the last two or three years, is to just trust that what I'm doing right now is where I should be. And I am exactly where I should be right now, even though I might not be where I want to be in the future, you know, like we've just talked about. So I want to work with people that are doing those extraordinary things daily. There are lots of places for people to go that have been exposed to domestic violence, and you know, fortunately, that is something that I never experienced. I never, thankfully, experienced physical violence in my relationship. There are lots of people who do. There are lots of people, you know, when I look at my experience in my relationship on a scale of sort of 0 to 100, it's at the low end of the scale. It had a huge impact on me, but it's at the low end.
Okay.
And there are lots of places for people to work that are at the high end of that scale, but I don't think there are many places for people to work on the everyday stuff, the stuff that just doesn't feel right. You know, I'm not being hit, I haven't been sexually abused, all of those things that people experience, that, you know, we can say, oh, well, he didn't hit me, or I haven't been sexually abused, but, you know, and then negate how we feel. So I really want to work at that end, because that's, you know, the other end is not my experience. And there are lots of people, sadly, that are far more highly qualified for me.
Okay, brilliant. Yeah. Thank you, Elaine. That's fantastic. And for me, it's about maybe we don't need to have the answer. Maybe we just need to keep asking the questions.
Yeah, exactly.
Brilliant. Thank you. You've been listening to Katie Day and Creating Ripples. Listen in and be part of the revolution that is rocking the world. Women over 50 are the new future. We are awesome, fearless, fabulous, inspiring, passionate, courageous. In fact, we just rock.